corner hardware stores have to maintain their relevance in an age of online sales. And if that means catering to some unusual requests, well, so be it.
One day we got a comment that said, please draw a flying dolphin on my box. So I was like, well, okay, I can do that.
How mom and pop hardware stores helped build this city and how their role may be changing on KCUR's Central Standard. That's coming right up. Three-story hardware shop called Epstein's sits on the corner of 8th and Central, in the heart of downtown. If you've been to the Phoenix for a drink, you know the corner. Epstein's is right across the street. Like many hardware stores, it's where you go when you've got a problem to solve. A leaky faucet or a broken door hinge. But the generations-old mom-and-pop establishment has a DIY challenge of its own. Once surrounded by industry and now surrounded by restaurants and office spaces, Epstein's has to reinvent itself in an era of online and big box stores. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll explore the changing significance of the neighborhood hardware store here in Kansas City. To start, KCUR intern Coy Duggar takes us off that sidewalk and inside Epstein's.
The Harry J. Epstein Company has been working out of the same brick-and-mortar building for over 80 years, so stepping through the door is like stepping through time. The shelves are lined with packages of screws and bolts, saddles and leather utility belts dangle from clips. Bins are stocked with piles of steel hand tools. Your purchases are rung up on a 1920s cash register. At first glance, it might look like an old-time hardware store, but walking past the shelves, you might see a 60-inch pipe wrench. Seriously, a 5-foot wrench. There's even an oversized socket that weighs about 100 pounds or more, which you might find as part of an oil rig. Many of their quirkier items have tales of their own, like this small metal ring with a hook at the end. Jory Sacken has to give a whole history lesson to explain the story behind it.
So in World War II, we had a problem with subs. So someone came up with the idea of this bomb tether, which is to take four 100 bombs and just tether them together. So when they drop, they fall in a cluster. It was essentially the first cluster bomb. You know, they needed these like crazy until they didn't, you know, until the war ended.
Selling leftover odds and ends, like the tethers, is one of the key aspects of a surplus business.
We have to take something and that's no longer useful for what it was designed for, and figure out something else to do with it. So one guy in New York used these to hang Christmas lights. You know, some construction workers will use them for hammer holders. You know, some people just like them for the object and the story, you know, that goes along with it.
Jory is the fourth generation owner and great-grandson of the hardware store's founder, Harry J. Epstein. One of Jory's key roles at the store is working as webmaster. He says that online sales now account for 50% of their business.
We've gone from just selling locally to the contractors, construction companies, people here in Kansas City, to selling all over the world. So we have customers in Thailand, we have customers in Australia, Canada, England.
Online sales have even prompted Epstein's to start a new department.
We have a comments box when people place an order, and typically people were like, oh, leave it on the front porch or, you know, something like that. Well, one day we got a comment that said, please draw a flying dolphin on my box. So I was like, well, okay, I can do that. And so I did that and I posted a picture of it online. And then maybe 3 weeks later, somebody else wrote in, like, please draw this. And so it just kind of picked up steam. And so now we have a box art department in our shipping.
This is the internet and all, so people aren't afraid to submit weird art requests. Box artist Matt Toddy shares his favorites.
I like the dragon-elephant combination. Or some people get really specific. I think they want to play Stump the Box Artist, and it's like two dogs working on a tractor while one dog's being lazy and the other one's drinking lemonade. Like, very in-depth descriptions.
Yeah, here's one.
This one came in today. Draw me your coolest looking parrot/peacock hybrid that shoots fire from its beak and wreaks havoc on a tree on the moon or something like that on the box.
Crazy art requests aside, the online market has affected Epstein's sales significantly. But not much has changed in the long run. The store is just as quirky now as it was in its beginnings. In the 1930s, after the dissolution of the U.S. cavalry, the original Harry J. Epstein jumped at the opportunity to buy a bunch of decommissioned spurs, which were being sold in large quantities and for cheap. Steve Sacken, the third-generation owner and Jory's father, recollects.
When my grandmother found out that he'd spent all the family's money on these spurs, she was ready to kill him.
While those spurs may be long gone, the old-time charm and assortment of tools and oddities still attracts a lot of people, like Bill Carter, who is wandering the aisles.
I come down here with my friends every once in a while. We just like to look at their stuff. I'm retired as a millwright at General Motors, so I work with a lot of tools, and this is just an interesting place to come look at.
And there's another reason Bill likes to shop at Epstein's.
I just like the thought of keeping my money here in the U.S.
Old hardware stores like Epstein's have a unique scent. Some would call it musty, but Steve Sacken says a lot of people find it nostalgic.
The smell you're going to get in a Lowe's or Home Depot is not the same as the smell from a building that's been here for over 100 years, that has wooden floors and a lot of leather in it. And you know, maybe it's just the smell of history and the smell of dirt and oil and grime and leather and cardboard. But it's not an antiseptic smell that you're going to see in, you know, the big box stores.
Steve says there's other things big box stores don't have, and he's not just talking about that smell either. Epstein shows that you don't have to sacrifice tradition to be innovative. Sometimes you can make room for both.
Thanks, Coy Duggar, for that dispatch from Epstein's. Retail is changing, and trying to pretend that it's not certainly isn't an effective business model. Even if you recognize that we lose something if we let go of those face-to-face interactions, the relationships we may have taken for granted, those quirky places with so much history. Sam Shublum is with us to talk about the role of hardware stores in our lives, because a lot of us think that what we do in these stores is strictly utilitarian, but maybe we're missing something. Hi, Sam.
Well, hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. How about you?
Very well, thank you.
We've been told that you are an authority on all things hardware, but perhaps more importantly, you used to work at Tucker's Hardware. When was that?
Oh, that was back in the 1980s. I worked at Tucker Hardware. It was they were more of a wholesaler and industrial supply place over in Kansas City, Kansas on Minnesota Avenue. And it was very much like Epstein's. It was a multi-story brick building with creaky wooden floors and obsolete archaic inventory that they never got rid of. And,
like what?
And there were horse collars over there, and there were buzz saw blades, what they called eveners, double trees, which you hooked horses up to a wagon, things like that. That were the guy that ran that place, Dan Tucker. He used to have, I don't know, four or five maxims of Dan Tucker's maxims of business. One was, something is better than nothing. You can't go wrong with doubling your money. If you can't be satisfied with 6.5% return on your overall capital investment, you're better off drinking it. And the other one was, and this gets back to these buzzsaw blades and horse collars, if somebody shows up and shows an interest in something that has been sitting there for 25 years or more, this is not the time to cut a man a deal.
Yeah. That's funny. Well, who came in and what did they typically want? I assume that even if they left with a horse collar, that wasn't what brought them.
Well, you never know. And that place had more of a commercial clientele. And there were a lot of the industries up in the Fairfax District bought from up there. The city, Kansas City, Kansas, Board of Public Utilities used to buy it. But it ran the gamut from mousetraps to micrometers. That was their slogan.
Forgive me, but what is a micrometer?
That's an instrument for measuring small increments of length on something, you know, like a
that's
like
a thing
caliper.
I don't need to do very often personally,
no, but,
which is
but the
forgive
mousetrap
me for not
part,
knowing.
You might know it.
Yeah. And, well, so how did you help them? I mean, what was the role of the person at the hardware store in fulfilling all these needs?
Well, you needed to guide someone through the very often they would show up and they'd think they know what they want, and they didn't. They didn't have any idea what they wanted. And I remember one time they said someone was talking to me, because this policy of the customer is always right doesn't apply to this place. And old Dan Tucker said, you know what? If the customer was right, they wouldn't be in here to begin with. So it was there was a tolerated surliness that was accepted that you don't find in modern retail anymore.
Is that a sort of, I mean, is the idea there that the customer needed you because you knew things they didn't?
I think that's very much the truth. And I always said what sold hardware was two things. Do you have it and where is it? You know, do you have any quarter inch, which, 4 inch lag bolts? Yes, I do. Right. Follow me. And then you stride with authority over to the bolt bin and point in there and say, here they are right here. And at that point you could say they're $11 a piece. It didn't make any difference. You knew where they were and they were and here. They're here. And you found them. You go into a modern big box store and, you know, do you have any quarter by 4 inch lag bolts? Well, yeah, I think we do. And they're probably over on aisle 13 and there might be a guy over there that knows. And nobody speaks with authority and strides to the product. Like
so you got to stride to the product and point with authority at the bolt the customer is looking for. Well, were there a lot of places like Tucker's around in the 80s?
Oh, yeah, there were still a lot of them. And we were talking about that earlier. They're all gone except Epstein's that I can think of. There was Stowe Hardware in the West Bottoms, Richards & Kahn, Rich Kahn, Faith Hardware, Townley, Bunting Hardware—they were—they were all kinds of them, and they've all disappeared.
What happened, in your view?
Well, I think the a lot of thing was the rise of the big box store, which no longer needed a distributor. They bought their products directly from the manufacturer. There was no distributing middleman involved with it, and that in turn caused the collapse of, or, you know, the demise of these little mom and pop stores who bought from these places. The whole thing sort of just dwindled away.
What accounts for some, like those straggling few that are still around?
Well, I think the reason Epstein's is around is, and you hit the nail on the head earlier, they've reinvented themselves a half a dozen times. The charm of Epstein's is that you walk in and you think, well, this place is unchanged for 100 years. It looks exactly. It really hasn't. It has changed. They've mutated along the way, and they sell stuff online. I think that their online sales probably account for a major part of their business anymore. Before it was years ago, They've Harry started selling, you know, like I said, he bought the cavalry out at Fort Riley, and he bought carloads of mule harness, and in the 30s there were still people using horses and mules, particularly down south, and they would sell to these guys. They called them wagon box traders. They were guys that the term comes from, you know, they had a box wagon, a horse-drawn wagon. Of course, by that time they were probably using trucks, but they would have these routes that they would go down south and sell this stuff. Well, by the end of the war, we're mechanized in agriculture, and he was probably out of harness by that time anyway. Well, then all this after the war surplus stuff starts coming online. Then as industry started collapsing in the United States, these tool companies started to fade away. Well, they liquidated a lot of their inventory as these tool companies went out of business. And the whole thing, they just have constantly reinvented themselves, and that's the reason they're still here.
I think a lot of us have the vague feeling that we lose something if we switch from this kind of neighborhood hardware store, or maybe we're still in the process of losing that. But I'm not sure we have I don't have the familiarity with hardware stores to be able to put my finger on exactly what it is we're losing. I mean, I can still buy whatever it is I need. My hardware needs are not great, admittedly. And I don't think most of us treat hardware purchases with a ton of sentimentality. Like, if I need a certain kind of screw, that's not something that sends pangs of longing through my being. So what do you think we lose?
Well, if you narrow it down that far, I don't know if I can get that philosophical. Let's see. The big thing that we have lost in that is the what we used to call a hardware man. That's what he was. He was a hardware man. You know, you could ask him questions about plumbing and you know, fasteners and paint and everything else, and they knew the answer to it. And you don't have that anymore. The turnover in these modern stores is so high. Nobody's going to stay there long enough to learn the business the way these guys did. And to have a person like that, it was just an asset to the community. They were valued, really, because, I mean, they were free advice that you could go and it was usually pretty good advice. They had seen so much of the same, and a lot of it was repetitive, that people had the same problems.
Right, and, like the same kinds of houses in the same neighborhood, that sort of thing.
There was a guy out in Western Wyandotte County named Walt Hodges. It was a plumber, and he put the same set of bathtub filler valves in every house he built his entire life. Now, they don't know that at the, you know, True Value office or you know, anything like that, but the guy who's buying the plumbing at this hardware store knows that, you know, you better have a bunch of Gerber number 24 tub stems on hand or you're going to wish you had, you know, and they, the Home Depot or Lowe's, they would be out of them. They wouldn't know to stock very many of them. This little mom and pop guy, he would have, you know, two boxes of them back there because they knew that was the common thing.
Well, we're going to get back to what's going on with hardware stores now, but let's hear about how they shaped various corners of our city. We've started to hear maybe about, on a micro scale, one Wyandotte County neighborhood and the plumbing there, but Monroe Dodd is our resident historian here on Central Standard. And Monroe, take us way back, like all the way back. Has Kansas City had a particular relationship with its hardware stores from the very beginning?
An American city in the 1850s and 1860s and all through the rest of into the 1880s at least, especially out here west, needed stuff built. If you wanted to put up a fence, if you're going to hang a door on a house, you're going to build a house, build a stable, build a building, something like that. To build these things, you needed certain objects to form them together. If you look in the dictionary under hardware, you typically get a definition of something like metal, small metal stuff. And after a while, you realize, oh, small metal stuff like hinges that go into making something else. And Kansas City needed a ton of that. Not only Kansas City from the Civil War on, but also all these little towns that served all these farmers and all these ranchers in places as far west as Colorado, across Kansas, down to Oklahoma Territory, up to Nebraska. Those were the stuff that things were made of. Just as, and hardware stores were right there with implement dealers and dry goods stores for clothing and feed stores for seed and groceries. It was mentioned earlier about wholesaling. Wholesaling was a big part of Kansas City's history, and yet nobody celebrates it because it's not nearly as interesting as running cattle or railroads coming in and out.
Like, the old wholesaling days.
The old wholesale days. Boy, I miss those. But in fact, a lot of Kansas City money was made on people like Tucker wholesaling to farms and little towns and little hardware stores out there in the darndest little places all across the Midwest. So that was a big part of not only the building of the structure of Kansas City, but making the money in Kansas City.
Hardware is a funny word, which I would never have thought of, except that I was getting ready for a show about hardware. I mean, software also is a funny word, but when we say hardware, what did that mean early on, and has it changed?
Well, again, it meant stuff that was hard, made of metal often. In fact, if you take apart your computer, the hardware in it is stuff that you can feel, as opposed to stuff that you think is there. You got off some disk, the software. So it's hard stuff used to build other things. If you buy a hardware store of the 1860s would sell you nails, and they would also sell hammers.
But no foam, because that's soft.
Right. They would sell pliers. And by the turn of the century, they were selling all kinds of stuff. Tools for cutting the bristles on pigs and shaving the manes of horses. By the beginning of the 20th century, hardware stores were branching out. You mentioned earlier reinventing themselves. at the end of the Civil War, if you wanted something, you would go to a hardware store that advertised itself as a hardware store, and you'd buy it, the way you would go to a grocery. And you'd say, I want a can of corn. The grocer would reach up, pull down the can of corn. Anything else, you'd say that. By the turn of the century, there were hardware dealer associations and magazines and marketing things that would put the 21st, make the 21st century seem not really so modern after all. The idea became you not only went to the hardware store here and anywhere for what you wanted or needed, but for stuff you didn't even know you wanted. They would talk about store displays and package this and the end of aisle things and other stuff. Hardware stores began in the early, by the turn of the century, to branch out into all manner of things. By the 19-teens, Bunting Hardware was selling Christmas toys and had its own Santa.
When would you say Kansas City peaked in the number of hardware stores that operated here and the volume of business that went on in them?
I have not counted the hardware stores in every single city directory, but I did find that before the crash in the late 1920s, the city directory listed, just in Kansas City, Missouri, 170 places that called themselves hardware stores.
170 just in the KCMO limits?
Yes, and if you imagine at the time, in the late 1920s, Kansas City, Missouri probably had 250,000-300,000 people. The metro area maybe 500,000. That's a lot stuffed in. You mentioned neighborhood hardware stores. I believe we're talking about some were itty-bitty places, and others were really big places, like Bunting at 8th and Walnut was claimed to be, and by all evidence is, the largest retail hardware store in Kansas City at the time. Nowadays, if you go between the Yellow Pages, which doesn't necessarily list everyone anymore, and the Internet, and do some quick calculations and say, well, that's enough calculating for now, you could come up with about 90 places that call themselves hardware stores, of which 25 are big boxes, Home Depot and Lowe's. Of the remaining 70 or so, about 50 are allied with True Value or Ace, and then the others are just sort of out there with a few other things. But so I imagine the late 20s seems to be the time when there were the most places calling themselves hardware stores.
What was going on in Kansas City, Missouri at that time that accounts for that? Can you even begin to extrapolate such a thing?
Oh, sure. The 1920s, like the 1880s, was a big growth decade for Kansas City. The 1880s, the largest percent population increase, the biggest booms in money, and there was a bubble in, a real estate bubble. And naturally, there was a construction bubble, and hardware sold a lot. 1920s was something of the same way. We all know about the market growing and growing and growing until finally the bubble burst in 1929 and 30.
Including the hardware store bubble?
Probably, because if you don't have people out there, many people to buy it or disposable income, you ain't selling.
Hold that thought. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll get right back to the story of the hardware store after this break. But first, a local perfume maker who's perfected that hardware store smell on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're talking about hardware stores and how their role in our communities is changing. Call 816-235-2888 with your hardware store memory or observation. That's 816-235-2888 to chime in on this discussion. We'll get back to our previous guests in just a moment. But now, let's hear from Jill McKeever, who has a Kansas City-based perfume label called For Strange Women. Because you can't talk about hardware store nostalgia without talking about that smell. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So you have created a hardware store scent?
Yes.
What made you want to do that?
I believe Jory asked me.
So Jory, that's Jory Sacken, who we heard in the Epstein's story just a little while ago.
Yes.
How did you go about the project of making it?
Well, I had been visiting Epstein's, and Jory had been providing me with like some vintage and antique glass from old military surplus from Europe. And, you know, I package a lot of my perfume in old fashioned bottles because it's made in an old fashioned way from botanical materials. So I was really like fascinated with the supply that they had there. And when he suggested that I make a perfume, I thought, well, that would be really fun, and I'll do whatever is inspiring to me. And Epstein's has a great scent, and so I just started working away at creating like a leather accord and a cardboard type of a scent and all of these things that existed in Epstein's and just put them together.
So did you have to do several different mixtures and proportions before you got it just right?
You know, Epstein's came together pretty easily, probably because I had been making perfume for so long at that point. But it was definitely needed some tweaking because I was realizing like, oh, there's not enough of a metal smell. And how can I achieve a metal smell with
how
plant
can you?
Oils?
Yeah. How do you do that?
Well, so I use plant oils. And a lot of times, you know, you wouldn't think that you could take something plant-based and make something completely new out of it. But I can smell things for, you know, what they are elementally and when they are combined, what new types of scents you can get. And I noticed that green pepper and myrrh mixed together can make a nice metal smell.
So you had been hanging out in Epstein's already. And I think sort of counterintuitively, I mean, people, when they imagine why does someone go to a hardware store to look for vintage metals that or vintage glass that comes from the Kansas City area might not be an obvious reason. How did you know that they would even have that?
Well, I knew Jory first, and so he had approached me and said, hey, I have a lot of stuff that you might like. And so I probably would have never discovered Epstein's if he hadn't told me about it. And so I go in there and he's like, let me show you all this stuff. And I was just like blown away because I really like unique places and eclectic places. And I could see that there was so much personality infused into the place to begin with his family. And like we were, you know, talking about earlier with him drawing pictures on boxes and the window displays are amazing. And then when he was showing me the huge boxes of scrap leather from, you know, old factories that had been making luggage and stuff. So I make a lot of stuff and I make a lot of packaging, and I was really excited to see all the types of materials they had for artists there, actually.
Did this smell jump out at you before you went on to make your scent, or did it take Jory's prompt to make you say, yeah, this is a smell I could capture?
Well, this was about 2 years ago, and I think from what I remember, Jory was like, hey, how about an Epstein's perfume? And I was like, yeah, because there was a very unique scent there, and I love capturing.
Even among hardware stores?
They, you know, nostalgic scents are one of my specialties for what I create, and there was a lot of nostalgia there.
Can you give some other examples of nostalgic scents you create, just to help people think of that as a category of smell?
Well, a lot of custom perfumes I do for people are made to recreate some place that they loved to be in childhood. Part of my line, you know, it has a lot of places that I've been or even objects that I love that I've recreated the scent of, like violin in the attic. I found my grandmother's violin in an attic, and so it was like very special to me, and violins have a certain smell. There's also like Winter Kitty, which is the smell of a cat that goes outside in the snow in the winter and gets kind of fireplace smoke stuck to its fur, and that's a very specific smell to me that other, you know, crazy cat ladies would appreciate. So I do all kinds of stuff like that. And so hardware store, totally not out of my arena at all.
What is it about scent that captures a place in a way that other scents maybe don't? I mean, what will this scent capture about the hardware store that a photograph maybe wouldn't?
Scent has a unique ability to be processed in your brain in a way that it bypasses the analytical part, and just you feel it emotionally, and then you trigger a memory, and it's a much closer emotional connection than if you see it. So the visual cortex, you know, you see it and you remember it. But the smell, sometimes the thing is you remember it last. It's just that you feel it first. And that's a much stronger connection to being there.
Do you have powerful hardware store memories or associations yourself that get evoked by the hardware store smell? I mean, have you worn this scent and felt something from it?
I didn't grow up in vintage hardware stores or anything. So what I really appreciate about it is just the extreme smell of history when you walk in. Like, you can tell that that exact building has been there a long time, holding these relics and these really unique items, and that it hasn't changed hands and it hasn't been cleaned out. Like, there's a lot of dust and cardboard and just old antique items in there. And I think a lot of people love the smell of antiques. And so there's a little bit of that, and there's a little bit of like old bookstore type smell, but with a lot more, you know, like hard edges, like metals mixed in. So
some old bookstore with hard metal mixed in. Well, Jill McKeever of For Strange Women, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Let's turn to Bob in Prairie Village. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
Great. How about you?
I'm doing fantastic. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. What do you got to share?
Oh, my gosh. This is one of the strongest memories, I think, that is evoked from my childhood, because I was born in 59. So by the time the mid-60s rolled around, I was helping my dad. And my dad was a real big hardware guy, do-it-yourselfer, doing the lawn. So Saturdays to me, and I grew up in Leavenworth, Kansas, and there was, maybe still is, I don't know, I don't go there often, called Gronus Hardware. Oh, my God. From the moment I walked in that place, just the smells, you know, and the history, the mechanics, the Rube Goldberg aspect of it.
The Rube Goldberg aspect.
The smells. Absolutely. My dad crafted some things that worked that he just thought, there's no way I'm going to pay for that, but I'm going to make it. But, I mean, it triggers strong memories. And to just hear about that alone, I've got to have that scent. Although I'm not going to wear it around the house, I'll certainly spray it on one of my work shirts. But it's the same. It's evocative of like the pages of old books for me, things like that, and music. It triggers such strong memories. And I knew Saturdays where we did a couple of things. We went to a little cafe. Dad had his coffee. I had something. And then we'd go to Gronus Hardware, and then we'd come home. We'd do the grass, the smell of the fresh-cut grass. Wow. I mean, it's hardware stores. They're just – it's sad that they are going the way that they're going, unfortunately. I know there's a lot. I know it's the Walmart. It's the box store. But I miss those little small ones with the guy that knew everything.
Well, Bob, thanks so much for that call. Sam Shublum, hardware store maven, what is the hardware store smell? I mean, as someone who's worked in these places and knows very intimately – item by item, what you're smelling.
Well, I think Jill pretty much nailed it on the, it was a combination, I think, between leather, oil, and there was a cardboard packing material smell. Like, there used to be a company called the Diamond Horseshoe Company, which mutated into, after there was no market for horseshoes, they started making, they were a drop forge plant, so they could make wrenches and pliers and things like that. And they used to package their pliers in these little cardboard boxes, and you coated them with a light oil like of cosmoline or something to keep them from any moisture out. And you would yank one of those packages open, and that aroma of that oil and that cardboard and the slight metallic smell to it that would come out.
Is this a smell you like?
Well, I don't think I'd want to, you know, bathe in a soap with it or anything like that, but made out of it. But it's not an offensive smell.
Why do you think people feel so strongly about it? I mean, listening to Bob in Prairie Village, it sounds like for him it captures a whole chapter of his childhood.
I think smells probably are one of your strongest memories, and particularly when you're young. And it's not a pleasant memory, but there I can remember when the packing houses were going to Kansas City strong in the 60s, and you drive across the inner city viaduct, or Lewis and Clark they call it now, I can drive across that today and smell that or remember what that smelled like, and it was not a particularly pleasant smell, but it's still there,
but it marks a whole chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Monroe, we talked about the 1920s. Are there any other eras that our nostalgia machines might take us back to if we're thinking about hardware stores in Kansas City?
Well, if you want to go back to the 1870s, when no one at this table, I don't think, even I wasn't alive, the hardware stores advertised themselves. One named J.W. Thompson, which was down on the riverfront, even closer to the river than the city market is, as selling stuff called outfitting goods for the plains, which meant if you're going to go out there, you're going to need this stuff to make a life of it. Nearby was another store called Cooper and Gregg, and it said, if you want to find us, look for the sign of the gilt anvil. Now, when I think of an anvil, I think of the anvil salesman guy in The Music Man who had to go from town to town selling anvils.
Totally.
It was a ridiculous idea because it's very hard to keep much of a sample box that way.
Anvils have limited sales appeal.
Exactly.
That was his line.
But here it was in the 1870s, they were selling anvils. So that's, I think, what I mean when I say it went from a place that you went when you needed something to a place where you go and you browse, and maybe you discover you need something. That's their hope, at any rate. I got to also add to the notion of the hardware man. Occasionally, I will stumble upon a real hardware guy. He might be working at one of the big box stores, or he might be down at a place like Strasser or a few others. And when I say stumble upon, I mean a person who can say, here's what you need or here's what you don't need. They used to do this. Now they do this. All those things, you go, my gosh, I've got an encyclopedia of knowledge about this one thing now because of this guy. That was valuable in itself, sort of like bringing back sense and memories and other stuff. The fact of coming upon somebody who knows that, and you still can.
Well, Sam, what would you say is happening right now with hardware stores, especially the neighborhood ones, and who still frequents those and why? I mean, talking about families and memories, I can imagine someone taking their kid to a hardware store and saying, this is where my parents took me when I got that first toolkit. This is where we went before that first lesson in how to hit a nail with a hammer.
Well, I saw that very thing happen last Saturday at Epstein. Somebody came in there with their son or grandson, I think it was, and he talked about how he'd been in there, you know, 50 years ago, and it was all exactly the same as it is now, and it's what makes those memories so strong? I don't know. If you like looking at that kind of merchandise. Or just being around the product, I suppose that would evoke a lot of memories for someone. But there was such a variety of things to look at in a hardware store. It wasn't and they had everything, I never tired of it. It was something always different to look at.
Let's hear from Amanda in Waldo. Hi, Amanda.
Good morning. Thanks for having me. I wanted to make the point you had asked the question earlier in your show, what do we lose when we lose the local hardware store? And I just wanted to say, it's just like when we lose any other mom and pop shop within our communities. You know, there's something really special about being able to do business with the people you live near and next to, with your neighbors, and being able to keep the money that you earn cycling through your own city, through your own community. And these are usually the businesses that give the kids in high school their first jobs and those types of experiences. And what you were just talking about, you know, taking the kids in to learn how, you know, to do the work and learn these skills that grandparents taught parents, and now they're passing on to their kids. So there's something really special that you can't get anywhere else.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and Central Standards got to take a break. When we get back, we'll have just a little more time for this discussion. We'll get some more of your memories, including thoughts about that hardware store smell. I'm Gina Kaufman. Be right back. Hi again, I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we are talking about the changing role of hardware stores in Kansas City. It's happening everywhere, even if our history is unique. I'm joined by historian Monroe Dodd and former Kansas City hardware store employee Sam Shublum, who's an expert in all things hardware. Hi again, Sam.
Hi.
Welcome back, Monroe.
It's good to be back.
Let's turn to Michael Michael, I don't know where you are. Where are you?
Oh, I'm in Ottawa.
Great.
And I wanted to talk about Brown's Hardware, no longer in existence. But my son was born in 1970, and so from about 78 to 82, he and I used to go in there a fair number of Sunday mornings when the store was open. And it seemed to be a place for men, but men with their sons that would go in there. And
we've
we
heard,
didn't go to church.
Yeah, we've heard about this idea.
Go ahead.
Well, we've heard about the idea of the hardware man as far as, like, who worked there. But the idea that this is a place where men also went, it's interesting.
Yeah, to hang out. And there was, of course, the smell, but there were a different kind of acoustics in a hardware store, I always found. The sound was dead but not deadened, you know. There wasn't much echo, reverb, but it was kind of an airy sound. Anyway, it felt like kind of church.
Well, it makes sense. You know, like wood floors and
yeah, squeaky and oil and rubber and metal smells.
So it felt like church to you. That's really cool. Thanks so much for the call, Michael.
Yes. Yep. Thank you.
The hardware store sound. I never thought about that before. Let's talk to Matt in Baldwin City. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. How about you?
Great. This is pushing all my happy buttons. I just love Epstein's. It's really the holy of holies and has really a great relationship with kind of the art student experience in Kansas City. A lot of us who went to the Kansas City Art Institute, you know, really just came to understand and appreciate Epstein's.
Can you explain that some more? Because
people in the sculpture department, such as I was. But I think what they're saving factor really is that they're a merchandise brokerage, and they've always gotten really interesting, quirky things. And like they bought the final production run of Diamond Tools when they shut that down, I think. And I remember going in there after, and there are great stories that we swapped going in there with Steve Sacken. I'd go in there and he'd say, "Can I interest you in an East German riot shield? It comes with its own whip," and it's just amazing stuff. And they're just I really have really heard a lot of interesting stories. And but probably the most amazing one was the story that Steve told me about how back in the 1930s Harry Epstein's brother came to him and said, "There's a guy in town making a movie that's a cartoon. It's a 2-hour cartoon. What do you think?" He's looking for investors, and he said, "Nah, don't have anything to do with them." And it was Walt Disney.
Yeah, well, I'm sure Walt Disney approached a lot of people for investments in this city, but the connection there between art and the hardware store, it sounds like, continues to this day. I'm intrigued by the idea that part of what gets swapped at a hardware store is stories.
Well, hardware stores are a font of stories, and they attract a lot of quirky characters.
Well, why are they a font of stories?
Oh, I don't know. There's a I can't put my finger on that as to why it is, but I don't know. I've never had any problem hearing a story in a hardware store, and it's pretty much my main venue as far as performance goes. I tell most of my stories in hardware stores. They seem to be an appreciative audience, anyway. And it's a they tend to generate their own stories. I don't know why, but
when I think about the potential for things to go wrong on a home improvement project, it's huge. And things going wrong is usually part of a good story.
Oh, I suppose you're right. The whole nature of the business, especially Epstein's business, that's rife. Every transaction is worthy of a story. They had and I'll tell one little Epstein's, one of my favorites. Steve Sacken went out at a government auction one time trying to find to buy some raincoats. And he gets outbid every time. They've got a pile of these raincoats, and he can't get them bought. And there's one pile left, and he's made up his mind he's going to buy these things. Well, as they do in a lot of auctions, if there's nobody bids on the previous lot, they'll lump it in with the next lot to move it to get rid of it. Well, the previous lot in this case was what it turns out they were periscopes for looking at the bottom of a B-52 bomber to see if your wheels were shot off or something. Nobody knew what they were. And so they lumped these things in. And so he buys these, he gets these periscopes with the raincoats. And he says, and I gave too much for those raincoats. And He gets home. Somebody tells him what these things are. And in, you know, several months later, the people that manufacture these write him a letter. Well, we see at such and such a government auction you bought these things. And have you got any left? Well, what's happened is the government has placed another order for these, and it's cheaper for the manufacturer to buy them from Epstein's and refurbish them, make sure they're okay, and then sell them back to the government again than it is to do another production run of them. So, of course, naturally, he didn't tell me what he netted in this deal, but he said, a real stern face, and we did real well. And then he just waited one comedic beat and says, and we didn't get hurt on the raincoats either. So.
Let's hear from John in Prairie Village. Hi, John.
Hello, Gina. How are you today?
Good. How about you?
Wonderful. My wife and I bought our first house in Prairie Village in 1975, and McMahon Hardware was down in the Village Shopping Center, and they had at least three or four hardware men in the store, as it's been described today. I went in there one day at the young age of 22 to do my first plumbing project, and one of the gentlemen decided to help me, and what are you going to do? And I told him, and he looked me up and down and said, it looks like a three-trip job. So we went back and got what I thought I needed, and sure enough, I needed more stuff, and I went back to the store, and I walked through the door, and he was sitting on his nail keg and held up two fingers and said, that's two. When it came time for me to go back the third time, I went somewhere else. I was too embarrassed.
Well, so the hardware store man could be an intimidating force.
Absolutely. But they knew everything. If you gave them your address, they knew what plumbing fixtures were in the house. They knew what light fixtures were in the house originally, just because they'd been there since the neighborhood started.
That's an amazing thing, that site specificity to the hardware store. Monroe, when you think about Kansas City and some of just the quirks of Kansas City and its architectural history and its infrastructural history, can you see a pattern there where the hardware store that's specific to a neighborhood might be really significant and important?
Well, you can go down to a loft called the Townley Lofts now, and there on the side, it's what is called ghost painting, I think, by a lot of people. It says tinners, tinsmiths. It served those people. It was a wholesaler. And what they were doing was making tin that you could put on ceilings and tin that you could put on roofs, which there are metal roofs now, but I don't think they're called tin. It's specific to its age. You can tell that right there. There's just not a lot of tinners going on or tinsmithing and so forth. So, yeah, you can see it, and you can even see it today, still in these old signs.
Let's talk to Mike in Lee's Summit. Hi, Mike.
How are you?
Good. How about you?
I'm great. Hey, I have just a couple quick comments. I know you guys are running out of time. My hardware memory is I grew up in a small farm in Lee Summit, and my dad was a jack of all trades, master of none, as they say. Old farmhouse, old barns, old equipment. So we would go into Rick's Hardware. The man who owned it had been there for decades. His sons worked there. They knew everything about everything. But I remember it was before the use of credit cards when I went in. It was in the 70s. So my dad would just grit what he needed, walk out the door and say, just put it on my bill. I always find that comical now. You just don't see that happening anymore. The other thing, the bright side on the Ace Hardware, you know, a lot of those are franchises. So I love going into old hardware stores in small towns, but a lot of times you see that Ace Hardware sign. So Ace in some ways has helped small hardware businesses stay in business because they bring that business model, the inventory, help with inventory, financing inventory. So, you know, it's considered a big box, but a lot of those are actual franchise, helping small business owners stay in business.
Well, thanks, Mike. And, you know, I actually want to get some response to that. Sam, it seems like something I read is that the minimum order is kind of a problem for some of these smaller shops. Does that business model that Mike just referred to kind of resolve that?
Yeah, and that has been around since the 20s. It's a they model themselves very much on the grocery store cooperatives as far as buying power. And Cotter and Company, that was True Value. They were in Chicago. Ace was another one. Century Hardware, the local distributor for that is Blish Mize up in Atchison, or Witte Hardware in St. Louis. And they're the basically the wholesaler for these mom-and-pop stores.
Monroe, as we chug on out of here, I mean, when we think about the places that we've mentioned today, why are they worth remembering?
These places are worth remembering because if you don't know where you've come from, it's a lot more difficult to know where you're going.
That's it for today's show. I'd like to thank Monroe Dodd and Sam Shublum for a great conversation. Thanks, Monroe.
Thank you, Gina.
And thank you, Sam.
Well, thank you, Gina.
You can listen back to this discussion and send it around to your friends and family at kcur.org/centralstandard. Maybe it'll bring up some old memories that they'd forgotten. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it ready for you by the end of today. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.